This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, migrant tensions grow over Europe's asylum policy. Burkina coup leader pledges to step down. Caffeine plays tricks with chemicals in your brain.
This particular finding tells us that the timing of sleep and wakefulness will be pushed later because of an effect on the clock, not just promoting wakefulness chemicals in the brain.
A television blockbuster begins its final season. We'll tell you about the end of Downton Abbey. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Europe faces a task of processing hundreds of thousands of refugee applications and identifying those in genuine need of asylum. As we hear from Henry Ridgewell at the Croatian-Serbian border, there are claims that some migrants are carrying fake Syrian passports, creating tensions with Syrian nationals.
Tens of thousands of migrants have walked along dusty tracks through the cornfields and across Serbia's border with Croatia in recent days, trying to reach Western Europe. VOA spoke to three Syrian men in their early 20s making that journey. They asked not to be identified and were quick to voice anger at some of the other migrants.
Too many people here have a Syrian and IDs, passports, and they are not Syrians. Yeah. They are from Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, too many.
And actually, I'm really shocked because this is our problem, this is our case.
Yes.
But Iraqi migrant Sadek told VOA he and his family should be entitled to asylum because they are escaping the Islamic State terror group known in Iraq as Daesh.
You must know this information for all the Europeans. The Daesh is not known just the Syrian, because the Daesh is coming from Iraq and the Syrian and everyone. That hit for everyone.
Mohammed, an asylum seeker from Afghanistan, voiced resentment at the focus on Syria.
Syrian refugee is all of process is very high, but the Afghan refugees, no. All of things for Syrian, not for Afghans.
Who is a genuine refugee fleeing conflict or persecution, and who is a so-called economic migrant escaping poverty or looking for a better life? Hungary, which is building fences on its southern borders to keep out all migrants, wants Europe to enforce the distinction. Zoltán Kovács is a government spokesman.
A joint European force that is able to stop illegal migration and establish the form, the protocol by which we are able to separate genuine refugees who are in real need of shelter from those who are only economic migrants.
European leaders plan to hold an emergency meeting on the crisis Wednesday. Many say part of any solution will be identifying the genuine refugees, but migration experts say the distinction is rarely black and white. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News on the Croatian-Serbian border.
Almost 500,000 migrants have arrived in Europe so far this year. Human rights officials say about 40% are from Syria. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States plans to issue up to 100,000 refugee visas a year starting in 2017. That's up from the current 70,000 in the current fiscal year, ending at the end of this month, September 30th. Beginning October 1st, the U.S. will allow 85,000 refugees to resettle, including a minimum of 10,000 Syrians. Some Republican lawmakers are warning that terrorist groups like the Islamic State will use the refugee crisis to try to enter the United States. Regional analyst and associate professor Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver in Colorado told International Edition's Victor Beatty the vetting process should be manageable.
The estimate is 2% of them could be ISIS fighters, or maybe even as high as 5. So I think both sides have a point. I think clearly this is not a very large number compared to the 4 million Syrians who've already fled the country and another 7 million who've gone to other places within Syria. But on the other hand, it would seem to me that our intelligence ought to be fairly good enough so that we would be able to, you know, at least spot a significant number of them. So I think when you balance it out, it's a concern. I think it is up to the intelligence agencies. But on the whole, there are profiles that, you know, should, you know, select out those people that we might be concerned about.
Russia's military backing, according to Mr. Kerry at his comments on Sunday, for the Syrian regime risks sending even more extremists to the war-torn country and could further hamper any effort to bring peace. Does he have a point?
Oh, there's no question about it. But the problem is, whose responsibility is this? In other words, we had an opportunity 3 years ago to really back up and arm and train the pro-Western secular moderates. And we skipped over that. And the result is that things have degenerated. I mean, if you just look at the numbers I was just quoting, over 50% of Syrians have either been killed, 250,000, left the country, 4 more million, or 7 million, who are already upended from where they spent their entire lives. So the situation is getting worse, and you perhaps saw that even the French now are talking about coming back into the bombing campaign. So I would hope that the administration will rethink this. We need to stop ISIS, and at the same time, we need to be more committed, not just verbally, but also in reality, to overthrow a regime that has done such horrendous things that violate even the most basic human rights all over the world.
Some 80 more U.S.-trained Syrian rebels have reentered the country. Is that going to help change the calculus at all?
Well, not when you're talking about tens of thousands of people on the other side. I think that, and the earlier statistics were like 5 to 20. I think, frankly, the situation has just swept beyond what we can do in a kind of objective, moderate way. We've got to decide what kind of Syria we want. Does it matter to us? Or do we basically turn it back over to the Iranians, the Russians, and Bashar Assad? So I think there's a fundamental issue here that we really haven't confronted for a variety of reasons.
Syria's Foreign Minister Walid Mualim said on Sunday that Russia's growing military role in his country will prove to be a game changer in the fight against jihadists.
I think that's a byproduct to a certain degree, but I think fundamentally the Russians want to hold on to their longest and most traditional base, which is in Syria, and they've already got TARDIS as their naval base, and now they're going to have an Air Force base. So I think the Russians would be thinking about that, but their main interest, of course, like every other country, is what's good for them. And this reinforces their image, especially in Sunni Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, like the United Arab Emirates, like Jordan and Egypt, that Russia is a militarily reliable country on which they can rely because they're coming to the rescue one more time to Bashar Assad, who, as horrible as he is, they see as preferable to the other side.
University of Denver Associate Professor Jonathan Edelman speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Now a look at what's being said about the migrant issue and Syrian refugees in the world of social media. G. Abby Lee joins me with the latest. G, are people still talking a lot about it online?
Hi, Ray. Absolutely. Hashtag Syrian refugees was used in more than 83,000 tweets in the last 24 hours. One account that uses the hashtag a lot is an account belonging to Kim Posniak. She's a communications officer for Global Emergencies and Sub-Saharan Africa for the Catholic Relief Services. She's on Twitter at KimPOZ. In the account description, she actually wrote she's passionate about the situation of Syrian refugees. She shares a lot of tweets from the organization's breaking news account at CRS News. That account has obviously been tweeting a lot about Pope Francis' visit to Cuba and his upcoming visit to U.S., but has been really active on following the Syrian refugee crisis.
Angie, what about from Washington? Here in Washington, are any officials tweeting about the Syrian refugee situation?
And most notably from John Kerry, the top diplomat. He sent out three tweets Sunday, and they were all about the refugee crisis. For example, he tweeted this: the U.S. will increase the number of refugees we resettle to 85,000 from around the world and at least 10,000 from Syria in fiscal 2016, 100,000 from around the world in fiscal 2017. Nearly 400 accounts share that tweet. He also tweeted about Germany's efforts in spearheading the EU's policy toward welcoming migrants and refugees. Here's a tweet: important discussions with Foreign Minister Steinmeier on Syria refugee crisis. Germany's culture of welcome sets global example. Kerry's on Twitter at John Kerry. Ray?
Thanks. Social media reporter G. Abby Lee. And you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's spelled JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. The leader of last week's coup in Burkina Faso apologized to the country and says he is planning to hand over power to a civilian government. General Gilbert Diendéré says he'll step down as the country's de facto leader at the conclusion of talks mediated by the Economic Community of West African States. The regional group will be holding an emergency summit in Nigeria's capital today to discuss the situation. Reporter Emily Yob is in Ouagadougou following developments and spoke earlier with International Edition's Jim Stevenson.
Today we have heard that troops from the Burkina army was driving to the capital city, to Ouagadougou, and have asked to the people behind the coup to lay down the weapon and to basically surrender. And like in Ouagadougou right now, when the news spread in town, people would just like leave home, and it's basically a ghost town. There is a curfew on right now, and the town is basically empty except outside the building where the general is. There is a rumor that the general is there, the Putschist leader. So there is like some people gathered there, but it's just a rumor, and nobody knows for sure where he is.
There was a statement at the conclusion of talks mediated by the Economic Community of West African States that the general who staged the coup will be, in fact, stepping down.
Well, that was one of the recommendations from the proposed peace deal that was announced. And today, the general indeed said that he was going to agree to this peace deal, and he was going to give back the power to the transition government, which he always said he would do. So it's just confirming what he always said he would do. But what he gets from the peace deal is an amnesty for the putsch, and he also gets included elections, which were the main domain of the putsches.
Well, that was going to be my next question, is what happens to the general and the presidential guard which staged this coup?
Well, we don't know yet, because the proposed peace deal very much criticized by anti-coup protesters. They have the feeling that that the putsches, that the peace deal is very much in favor of the putschists. That they get everything they wanted, and they have an amnesty, which means they're not being held responsible for all the injured people and the dead people that have happened in the past few days. And for many of them, it's unbearable. It has to be discussed tomorrow in Nigeria, this peace deal, but we don't know if it's going to be implemented. We don't know what the army intervention is going to change. It's a lot of doubt here.
Is there a sense that the interim prime minister, who is to be released, will return to power?
That is correct. One of the compromises that the general agreed on was to release Isaac Zida, the prime minister, who is also the former leader of the soldiers behind the coup. Yes, that's one of the conditions of the peace deal, and that the general agreed on.
Emily Yob, reporting from Ouagadougou, talking with my colleague Jim Stevenson. Chinese President Xi Jinping begins a week-long visit to the United States later today. His first stop, the northwest city of Seattle, Washington, for talks on business and industry. Then is off to Washington Thursday for his first state visit and wraps up his trip later on in New York. The United States and China share a number of delicate issues. VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ai talked about them with International Edition's Ira Melman.
They sure have a full plate, from the South China Sea issues, to cybersecurity, China's relationship with Japan, which is an ally of the United States. There are many areas where these two countries are trying to deal with their relationship and the challenges that rise up. And that's not to mention the other persistent issues that have long been there regarding human rights, whether it be in Tibet or Xinjiang, or just the average everyday citizen in China and the lack of freedoms that they do not enjoy.
Well, you know, if you were to list the thorniest problems, what would be at the top of your list?
Well, at this point, going into the meetings, it seems that cybersecurity is the top issue, and that is because of the impact that it's had on U.S. businesses. We're not talking necessarily about cyber espionage and stealing of maybe information about President Obama's meetings and what he's saying behind closed doors. The president made it clear that what he's really concerned about the most, President Obama, that is the theft of intellectual property and also it could be military hardware, secrets, technology as well.
Where do you see issues of common ground as she prepares to leave?
Well, we definitely know that in terms of climate change, this has been one of the areas where the two are trying to work together, trying to help set a standard for the rest of the world, and hopefully that one will follow. We'll have to see, you know, what kind of further agreements are made during the visit. The other thing is that she is bringing with him a big entourage of businessmen, so there may be some progress in that area as well. The two countries are also working on a bilateral investment treaty, and it is hoped that some conclusion or some progress will be made during the visit regarding that. So those are a few areas where we might see some progress come and should be some high points.
VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide speaking with International Edition's Ira Melman. Coming up, what caffeine is actually doing to your internal clock. This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
Race for Water is island hopping across the globe, but this is no pleasure cruise. The crew is making a global assessment of plastic in the ocean and concentrating on five areas where the pollution is especially bad. Frederic Siaka is a scientific advisor for the group. He spoke via Skype.
The idea is to stop on every remote island located in the center of the Chagos in order to assess the plastic pollution.
Plastic is not just an eyesore for sun-loving beachgoers. Once it breaks down, says Siaka, it gets into the food chain.
This is more like a soup and a mix of microplastic and big macro debris.
Siaka says the plastic can be eaten by marine life, even by tiny plankton. The Race for Water hopes its odyssey across the oceans will raise awareness of the issue.
To change minds and to maybe change the laws regarding waste management.
Siaka says the crew has been shocked by what they've seen so far, calling the plastic trash a disaster. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
This is VOA's International Edition. If you are just waking up, pay attention to this. You are probably drinking coffee to stay awake, but if you drink coffee or something else that's caffeinated too close to bedtime, you might not fall asleep. A new study explains why, as we hear from VOA's Jessica Berman.
Researchers at the University of Colorado Boulder and British investigators discovered that caffeine can delay normal sleep times by as much as 40 minutes if consumed 3 hours before anticipated bedtime. The amount of caffeine associated with sleep disruption was equivalent to what is typically in two shots of espresso, a popular after-dinner drink. Kenneth Wright is head of the Sleep and Chronobiology Laboratory at the University of Colorado, Boulder. Wright says some coffee shop brews typically contain more caffeine than that. Scientists have known for a long time that caffeine disrupts chemicals in the brain that affect wakefulness and blocks chemicals that promote sleep.
This particular finding tells us that the timing of sleep and wakefulness will be pushed later. because of an effect on the clock, not just promoting wakefulness chemicals in the brain.
This is important because the natural process of circadian rhythm also affects hormone production and cell regeneration in the human body. Not getting enough sleep could affect mood. It could also promote disorders like diabetes. To look into caffeine's effect on the circadian clock, researchers first noted the sleep-wake cycles of five healthy volunteers. Over the course of a 49-day study, investigators gave the participants 200 milligrams of caffeine, the equivalent amount found in two shots of espresso, a few hours before bed, and noted how long it took them to fall asleep. The volunteers were also exposed at night to bright light, which is known to disrupt sleep. Caffeine did more than bright light in interrupting the circadian clock and therefore patterns of sleep. The researchers also looked at the biological function of a sleep hormone and found caffeine interrupted a core component of sleep at the cellular level. Wright says adjusting one's biological clock in this way could also be beneficial.
Another example of an implication of our findings is we may be able to use caffeine to help shift our clocks westward when we're traveling across many time zones. And in this case here, caffeine may help us adapt to jet lag much faster.
The findings published in the journal Science Translational Medicine also suggest people who want to wake up earlier in the morning might consider giving up that nighttime cup of Java. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
One of television's biggest hits is Downton Abbey. The British series is now in its sixth and final season. Downton Abbey is viewed by millions around the world, so fans are eagerly awaiting the conclusion. Here's International Edition's David Byrd with a look at the world of Downton Abbey.
Downton Abbey is truly a worldwide phenomenon. The drama about the fictional Crawley family is shown in more than 100 countries. ITV, which commissioned the show, says an average of 11 million viewers watch the series in Britain alone. In the United States, last season's finale was seen by more than 25 million people. But now, the final season has come, and cast members have mixed emotions about it. Actor Hugh Bonneville, who plays family patriarch Robert Crawley, the 7th Earl of Grantham, says the time feels right for the show to close.
Originally it was going to be five, and then I went and had a chat with Julian, and I wanted to see the whites of his eyes about whether he wanted to do a sixth, and he explained why he wanted to do a sixth.
The show began with the sinking of the Titanic in 1912 and has followed the Crawley family through 13 years of love and tragedy. The sixth season will carry the storyline to the edge of the Great Depression. Elizabeth McGovern plays Cora, Countess of Grantham. She says that the storyline follows the history of large houses in England at the time.
They're not able to continue the life as they know it much beyond that, the decade of the 20s. So that sort of works well for the story. The lifestyle is ending as our series is ending.
The show is filmed at Highclere Castle in Newbury, West Berkshire, currently the home of the Earl and Countess of Carnarvon. The castle has provided fans with stunning views of its interiors, including the main staircase, the dining room, the drawing room, and the library. Downton Abbey has also been a boon for the castle, with tours selling out months in advance. The success of the series, including 59 Emmy nominations and 11 wins, surprised writer Julian Fellows, who thought that it was aimed mainly at a British audience.
And then it opened in America and became a very big hit there, and then China and Asia and, you know, Africa, and all of these whole continents took to the show. And I can't really explain why particularly, but I'm terribly pleased they did.
While many of the family scenes are filmed in the castle, the downstairs scenes involving the servants are done in a studio because the real kitchens and servant areas are not suitable. Jim Carter, who plays the strict butler Mr. Carson, says the final servants' scene turned out to be the final scene of the final episode, which made for an emotional wrap-up.
So we were in the servants' hall, all the gang, candle lit. Quite a sort of a muted sort of scene, not a big dramatic scene, quite low-key. And then they said, cut, and that's goodbye to all the servants. And then I sort of thought, oh, we should thank all the wonderful crew there. And I started to say a few words on behalf of everybody. Before I knew it, oh my God, I was a mess. And then I looked around and all the crews were like this, all the blokes all crying. And it was a soggy mess.
Very sad.
Michelle Dockery, Lady Mary Crawley to fans of the show, says though it's sad to leave her cast members, in the end, Downton Abbey is just a television show.
It's still a drama and there has to be some sense of, you know, it's make-believe, it's not real. So I think it's important not to take it too seriously.
Show producer Gareth Neame says that there's nothing to stop someone from making a newer version of the Crawley saga. But for now, he says that cameras are moving away from the Crawleys. Downton Abbey began its final season in Britain September 20th. American fans will have to wait to see it on PBS's Masterpiece beginning in January. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
And that's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, information, and videos by going to our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Economic disparity, often in combination with other factors, can open the door to violent extremism. Across many parts of the Middle East and North Africa, economic policies have led to the creation of parallel but deeply polarized economies, said U.S. Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Catherine Novelli. One is formal and often extends the full range of society's benefits to a relatively small and privileged group, but exacerbates perceptions of unfairness. The other economy is informal, marked by insecurity and characterized by low pay and little hope for a better future. According to the World Bank, the typical country in the Middle East and North Africa produces about 27% of its GDP in the informal economy and employs 67% of its labor force informally. In many countries, it is almost impossible for an individual to move from the informal sector to the formal sector, said Undersecretary Novelli. Women, she said, participate in the Middle East's workforce at the world's lowest rate. Many women, when they can't find jobs in the formal sector, become discouraged over time and end up dropping out of the labor force. ISIL has exploited these frustrations in its recruitment efforts by promising women valued positions in their state, and hundreds of women have fallen prey to this narrative. It is important to note that ISIL wants to cast blame on capitalism, or modernity, for creating many of these inequities. In the Middle East and North Africa, ISIL presents a false choice between the unjust status quo and a romanticized version of a 7th-century economy. The most effective way to confront these challenges is for countries to pursue sound market economy principles, embrace transparency and the rule of law, and ensure that all people have the opportunity to succeed. Embracing such reforms can go a long way toward blunting the message of violent extremists.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials. We'll be right back.
is for.